I'd like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you very much, Kelly. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the CCI call on the 22nd of May 2012. On the call today, we have Steve Del Bianco, Rosemary Sinclair, Tobias Marler, Cheryl Langdon-All. From staff, we have Barry Cobb, Maggie Sherrod, Liz Gaster, Paul Redman, and myself, Natalie Peregrine. We have apologies from Carl Zagiri, John Berard, Wendy Zelter, and Julie Headland. I would like to remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, Rosemary.
Thank you, Natalie. We've got our agenda before us, so we'll move straight into the review of open action items. Barry, would you mind taking us through this?
Yes, Rosemary, this is Barry. Our first one was to invite the compliance team on to the call today so we can discuss our deliberations about some new metrics, I think from mid-April, and we'll move into that just as soon as we run through the rest of these action items, but they are on the call, and we welcome them. Thank you. The second one was to update the public comment survey form, and I sent that out to the list just now. There was a question raised whether it included the USG comments, and at this time, this version does not include them. The reason for that is the formatting that they sent the PDF. I can't cut and paste any of the text to import into our tool, so I'm probably going to take the approach of attempting to summarize the main elements of their comments. And that way I can load them into the tool and we'll be able to review through them. I'm sure that there will be some good discussion about their comments that they submitted. The third action item is to send out to create the first drafts of letters to the GAC and to the third action item is to confirm that there is indeed a GNSO GAC session in Prague, and there is, and it's scheduled for Sunday afternoon. And we'll discuss more of that with respect to getting on the agenda items, but the GNSO Council is aware that we'll be trying to do a session on Saturday or Sunday with respect to consumer metrics, as well as I believe there will Jeff Newman is aware that we're looking to have an action item listed for the session with the GNSO GAC. The fourth action item was to draft the first letter for a formal response from the GAC with respect to the board with respect to the advice letter, which is what we'll review through after the session with compliance. And then the last action item is to create a first draft for our Prague session. And right now that's just a carryover, and we'll start busting that out next week. Mm-hmm. The only other thing that I'd like to bring up with respect to the remaining working group schedule, as you see over here on to the right, mm-hmm. We did have a target for submitting the final advice letter to the council on 12 June. But if I recall correctly, there was maybe a notion that we might postpone the formal delivery of that and so that we could give adequate time for the GAC to respond to that advice. Is that a fair statement? And Steve or Rosemary, do you recall if we wanted to adjust that schedule out?
Okay. Rosemary here. My recollection was that we did. I think we were trying to, in fact, not only give the GAC a little bit more time, but to allow the Prague meeting to happen before we absolutely finalised what we were doing. But I'm happy to be corrected on that if I've got that wrong. Pardon me.
Rosemary, it's Steve. I think we discussed the best of all worlds. If the GAC gave us some indication that that they would provide advice, that we'd be happy to wait for that for our final report. But it's not likely the GAC will either commit to a timeline or or anything like that, but let's at least ask, and if they won't commit to getting us something, we may have to proceed so that we don't hold things up at getting our stuff to the board.
Rosemary here. I think that's a good way to proceed, actually. If we keep 12 June as our target date and we shift it only if we have good reason, being that we've got some input from the GAC that we need to deal with before finalising our draft advice.
Okay, great. Very good. So that concludes the action items, Rosemary.
Thanks, Barry. So that then takes us into the review session with the compliance team.
And Rosemary, this is Barry. I'll kind of set this up. So it was in mid-April when we were reviewing through some of the comments from the Costa Rica session. I'm trying to pull this up onto the screen for everybody to see. But with respect, it was to Consumer Trust, and I believe it was from, yes, Rudy Vansnick. And his question was basically that trust is a flexible word. There are several definitions attributed to it. And he specifically pointed out how registrants were handled by registrars and do we need different types of trust. Over in the working group response section, this is a rough snapshot of our dialogue with regarding that. We first discussed the Internet site and its current state. And we also talked about future state with respect to the new GTLDs and registries and those kinds of things. We had talked about some the ombudsman complaint system and if there was any channel or path there by which complaints would be submitted about registries or registrars. And then we also basically had some discussion with respect to compliance and what requirements are available or are being derived for the new system as well. Long of the short, our recommended action is that we're going to be adding two metrics to Consumer Trust, which in detail is the number of general complaints submitted for registrars and the number of general complaints submitted for registries. With that discussion, it was also asked by the working group that we invite compliance onto the team or onto the working group and that we can have dialogue and discuss what's going on out there today. And that's pretty much the nutshell. And so I have a brief Paul and Maggie with respect to listening to the MP3 of that mid-April session, and here we are. So does the working group have any specific questions that they'd like to ask the compliance team, or Maggie, would you like to give us a brief summary of what your perspective is?
Okay, thank you, Barry. This is Maggie Siraj. I don't have, I'm not in front of a laptop. I have a personal appointment I'm tending to, so I apologize. I don't see the screen. But my understanding from here is that you have, the working group has certain questions, or are you expecting an update on where are we in relation to the systems to deliver metrics? Which part do you want us to talk to? I'm not clear on what is it, the discussion or the specific question being asked.
Well, Rosemary here, perhaps if I have a go, and then anyone else who wants to come in on the working group side can do that, and that will give Maggie a brief. My perspective on this whole issue, Maggie, is that we are working to come up with definitions for three main concepts: consumer in the context of ICANN, consumer trust as a state of being, if you like, and competition, again, in the context of the domain name system. Once we've established the definitions of those terms for our purposes, then we want to look at metrics, how one would work out where you are on a particular definition now and in 2 or 3 years' time in some cases. And then thirdly, we've had a philosophy with this work to try to identify metrics that are doable. We've early in our discussion taken a general position, a loose position, that if you came up with metrics that were too expensive or too difficult to firstly collect and then secondly report, then that wasn't a practical outcome. A number of the metrics that we're proposing relate in one way or another to the complaints system or the compliance system that ICANN is running. And in general terms, we're keen to understand more clearly what's being collected through that compliance system, how it's being measured and reported, and I suppose whether what we are suggesting would interpret current data and reporting in a particular way or require, pardon me, the collection and reporting of new data. So that's why, Maggie, I guess our interest in the compliance system is very general.
Yes.
And our questions are very general because we have this particular approach. Let me stop there and see if there is anyone else on the working group that wants to come in at this stage. And then I've got a couple of questions specifically. So seeing no hands, and if anyone else sees any hands, please let me know, as is the usual form with this particular working group. Seeing none, my first question, Maggie, is just this notion that we were just discussing about trust being a very flexible world. If you're in your helicopter right up on top of the ICANN compliance system looking down, do you feel, in fact, that you, and I know I'm using our terms, not your compliance terms, but do you feel that you... that there are different sets of compliance issues and compliance processes, that's my interpretation of your language, which might mean for us that there are, in fact, different sorts of trust, and that, of course, would take us to the point that we would have different sorts of things to measure and we might need more metrics. So perhaps if I could leave that background introduction and that particular question there, I hope that's helpful.
This is Maggie Surratt, for the record. Rosemary, thank you very much for the brief summary you set us in here. So what I would like to mention to the working group is along the line of what we had shared with different stakeholder groups, especially with the IPPC and different separate discussions, is we are at a point now where we are really, and I'm hoping to show to the stakeholders, including the working groups, how we are progressing in our reporting and transparency to the community. Because when we speak of consumer trust to the ICANN community, to ICANN and competition, it's about metrics, as you clearly stated. The metrics will be rolling out in a gradual mode based on current availability and future requirements. So we want to share with this group that by Prague, as I committed to all the stakeholder groups, is that we will be sharing metrics along the line of the different phases that complaints go through. In the past, we use to report at an overall picture, which is a total picture, and to the community, and especially to the different stakeholders. You know, it's like, what is it, what's in it for me? How can I tell the true story? So now, with the minor enhancements we're rolling out slowly into the current systems, as you stated, it's about time and money also. So the minor enhancements to align with the process will allow us to share not only complaints by different phases as they go through compliance, but also types of complaints. So we are building and prototyping a new business intelligence tool this trimester, leveraging on existing data. By establishing a foundation, we have feasibility studies underway for future tools where we consolidate the different systems compliance collects complaints through. For future, once we finish the feasibility study, as I had shared with Jonathan Zook, who is also a member of this community or this working group, is we will be expanding on metrics and think of it like a Rubik's Cube. You know, how can you slice and dice the data to address the consumer trust based on the different stakeholder groups? Because every stakeholder group in ICANN community is looking at it differently with a different interest. So by Prague, we will share with you the breakdown, the types, and hopefully also by Prague, we will complete our feasibility study, but I will not have all the relevant data we're working towards. And I can start sharing with you what we're working towards once we understand where we're going. Did I answer your first question, Rosemary?
Yes, Maggie, thank you. That I found that very helpful.
And Paul, I know you are on the call. Paul is the senior manager in compliance, overseeing performance measurement and reporting. And it's a very, very key role to our organization, not compliance only, but ICANN. So we've discussed with Paul, and I have had a call with Jonathan. When you speak of Internic, which is the very first consumer or customer-facing interface, we all know it is not a user-friendly. It is also on our plan to update that or replace that, but it is in the short-term plan, which means, you know, thinking towards more the October time frame, because decisions have to be made based on the feasibility first, where are we going. But Internic will have to be modified to your summary at the beginning. Today it's limited in functionality, it's not user-friendly, and it is not addressing the community needs. So consumer trust is earned once you are capturing what is it they care about. And Internic is the first face to compliance. And we are in the process of looking at what exists today, what needs to be added, not only but because of new GTLD. Even if new GTLD was not being discussed today, we need to modify Internic. It's not capturing the different aspects of complaint or the complainant's information, and we don't even follow up and follow through because it's not automated. So consumer trust has different phases from our perspective of measurement and reporting, and it has to be rolled out gradually as we roll out the tools and the technology.
Thank you very much, Maggie. Steve?
Thanks, Rosemary. Hi, Maggie.
Hello.
Let's see if we can cut right to the details here. We have a list of metrics that we'd hope that compliance would be able to help us with. They come into two buckets. There are complaints submitted by the community, which need to be categorized, and there are, of course, breach notices issued by ICANN, for which categorization is much easier, since ICANN can categorize its breach notices and suspensions and terminations even after the fact, and the quantity is relatively minimal. So let's just focus on the complaints that regular people would file using that Internic form that Barry pointed everybody to on the Adobe Room. Maggie, do you have access to the Adobe Room?
No, I'm sorry, Steve. I said at the beginning I am at an appointment here, so I'm not
All right,
at my desk.
Don't, I'll quickly read it to you. One of the comments we received on our draft advice comes from the U.S. government, and they took a look at all the metrics we'd had in there for complaints, and they wanted to suggest several other kind of complaint characteristics that they'd like us to capture. And I'm not even endorsing what they've asked for. I just wanted to understand from you whether you had these on your list, because I took a look at the InterNIC form, and it does allow the complainant to check the box for a spam issue. But the U.S. government also asked for metrics to include malware sites, sites used in botnets, sites associated with ID theft, sites associated with spam, that's the one you already have, breach notices that were given by ICANN for misconduct of officers, and I believe that would come from ICANN, not the complainant, and then finally security breaches that occur at a given contract party or potentially even a domain name holder who has personal data on their site. So what this would get to is whether there are plans to modify the InterNIC complaint form. It suggests to me that if we added checkboxes for a complaint about malware on a particular domain, whether it's part of a botnet network, whether the complainant believes it's associated with ID theft, and finally, whether there's been a security breach there. If you picked up just those elements, we'd be able to tick off the items, at least that the U.S. government has asked for in their letter. And Rosemary and the rest of the working group, on page 8 of our document, we had a list of consumer trust metrics, too, and I believe we've already verified that ICANN compliance can give us that level of granularity on complaints for what we already had in the table. Then I'll stop there. Thanks.
Steve, thank you for summarizing what I cannot say. the question you're asking, if I may restate, is there an opportunity to capture this type of complaints that relates to the different categories of malware? Is that what you're asking me?
Yes, whether the InterNIC complaint form, if in fact that's the complaint form that you're going to be modifying, whether it can be modified to capture 5 additional kinds of complaints.
By when do you need this type of answer? Because, again, the content, as we all know, we can capture them if that's what the intent is. But what do we do with it is the most important question. A lot of the complaints...
Maggie, that's actually not an important question. What you do with it is not an important question for this particular exercise. This is about data gathering and not remedies. So we only have to look at the data gathering aspect at this point.
Okay. So I would like, by when do you need an answer of if these new requirements can be captured? I would like to take it back and just review what does it mean. But I understand you only care about the first part. Mm-hmm. But again, when we capture complaints, if we don't know what we're going to do with it or we don't have a plan for it, the consumer trust will drop. It's going to go into a black hole. So I need to understand the bigger picture also.
Rosemary here. I think that's a very important comment that Maggie has just made, Steve, that, you know, from our point of view, collecting the data is what we're interested in. But from the compliance group's point of view, you wouldn't really collect data that you weren't going to do anything about. So you've got to think through the process. If I ask people if they're happy and they tell me they're not, then what do I do about that? Our time frame, Maggie, is that we have, 3 more meetings after this, 29th, 5th and 12th. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be extremely helpful now that we've had this discussion if you could look at the list of things that Steve has just suggested and our page 8 that Steve was referring to and come back to us possibly next week if you could, because this is a very important issue for us.
Rosemary?
Is that Michael.
It's Jonathan, I'm sorry.
Sorry?
It sounded like Jonathan, yeah.
Go ahead, Jonathan. I'll hold up for you.
But Michael.
Sorry, I guess I just want to clarify something, Rosemary, because I do see a scenario under which compliance might track data for the purposes of an affirmation of commitments review that are not necessarily items upon which they're going to act for contract compliance purposes. I mean, I think they have a narrower mandate for enforcement than we do for appraisal, if you will. I mean, we're trying to find some ways to look at some abstract concepts like increase in consumer trust, competition, and choice, and that's not Maggie's mandate. And so, I mean, I don't know that we want to saddle her with enforcing whether people are happy about something, nor do we want to be limited to only tracking data that Maggie's planning to use for enforcement purposes.
No, I understand that point, Jonathan. I was just trying to indicate that what we're trying to do here is make an intersection between the objectives of this working group and a compliance team that already is in existence and doing work.
I agree with that, Rosemary. My concern is if we just look at the point of intersection, we won't be tracking enough information.
Yes.
We can't just look at the overlap of our activities. We need to look expansively at what it is we've been chartered to do and make sure that we can get the data to do it, whether or not the compliance team makes the decision to use it for enforcement purposes.
Quite separate, Jonathan. In fact, what the first thing we've got to do, and I think we're there now, is get the compliance team to actually look at the breadth of our work. And I think that's what we've agreed at this meeting, that they will look at our work and come back to us. Michael and then Olivier.
I think actually, Rosemary, this is Michael Graham. I think what you just said is basically what I was going to point out. One, that there, and also Jonathan, that there is a difference between what we have been tasked and are tasking ourselves and suggesting to the review team that they review in order to meet the sort of analysis that we believe would be useful in coming up with, in determining whether or not the program has met its projected expectations. At the same time, I guess I see for the compliance team that to the extent that some of our measures are ones that, yes, they could include on InterNIC so that we can get some data, they might be things also that in future they may want to address in terms of finding a response especially insofar as some of this information is coming not from registrants or registries, but from the governments and such. It's an additional word that might help them out. But I think certainly, as Jonathan was saying, the raw data is what we need to get on our concern, and then compliance can hopefully move forward, and some of these concerns that we think are important will then decide that perhaps there is something that needs to be addressed on the second stage, other than just obtaining the data.
Thanks, Michael. Olivier?
Thank you, Rosemary. It's Olivier for the transcript. I just wanted to absolutely support the fact that the channel that compliance already has in being front-facing the customers for customer complaints be used, in fact, for additional, I would say, non-compliance-related information gathering. It would be great to have a one-stop shop for any complaints, and from there, the complaints either going to just for statistical reasons, which is what we're doing, or going to the compliance department, or going to the ombudsman, or wherever else. And the other thing I wanted to say was I think we shouldn't be and I think we're all in agreement on that. We shouldn't just be limited to matters of compliance there and think that compliance today is what compliance will be tomorrow. I am absolutely hoping that ICANN's compliance department mandate will expand in time as Maggie very well builds up her department and is given more tasks to clean up some of the darker sides of the DNS. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Olivier. Steve?
Thanks, Rosemary. We have so much work to do that we need not make questions like this more complex than they already are. And it strikes me that Maggie, this is a very simple request about modifications that you plan to make to the InterNIC form. And the questions are, can you add four elements to the radio buttons? That is malware, botnets, ID theft, and security breach. I realize, though, that InterNIC form is a bit of a mess. It conflates where a problem occurred with what the problem is. For instance, the current complaint form has a checkbox for ccTLD to select your issue. It has a checkbox for new DTLDs,
right,
which are really not complaints. They're some sort of a guess as to where the complaint occurs. And then there are a whole host of other radio buttons on there to indicate what the nature of the problem is. And the way I understand it now is that InterNIC form only allows a single radio button to be highlighted. You realize that? So if I had a problem with the ccTLD at domain renewal, I couldn't highlight both those things on the same form. And this form was probably designed way before you got there.
Right.
But the form has to separate between where the problem lives and what the problem is. And these four elements that the U.S. government has asked for are along the lines of the what. And when it comes to the where, we usually determine the where partly based on a specific domain name, which is a field they have to put in at the top. So if they put in a domain name that's in a new GTLD, well, that automatically covers the new GTLDs. You don't necessarily need to have another place to indicate it. But as Barry Cobb raised on the last call, we wanted to know whether we can discover if the nature of a complaint is aimed at a registrar or registry, the two sides of the contract party houses. And it's not always obvious until you dive into a complaint to figure out whether it really was a registry or registrar problem. And so this is a question for Barry as much as anyone else. Do we think that the complainant should indicate whether they suspect it's registrar and registry, or should that be something that compliance discovers when they dive into the actual complaint? And I can restate that question if it wasn't clear.
Rosemary here, let me have a go at it. Having looked at consumer complaints in other areas, the less you require the consumer to do at the point when they're making a complaint, the better. Because to try to get consumers to distinguish between structural elements in a system such as ICANN can be interpreted as putting a barrier in their way.
It would skew the data because, they don't actually have the ability to make that determination in many cases. They're lucky if they can spell ICANN. And I'm not being derogatory there. Their issue is to raise the complaint. And we're interested in mining data. One of the clear and obvious resources for the mining of this data is out of the material collected and the interactions that the compliance department have in their customer-facing situation. If we can't get that from compliance, well, then we'll have to get it from somewhere. Won't be a pity to put up a second set of resources to collect material that could be being collected via a department we already have, need expanding, and is already operational. I hope that's not too subtle, Maggie, but I think you might see where we're coming from.
Mm-hmm. No, I truly respect all the ideas that are being put on the table, Cheryl. The InterNIC interface, it's the second phase we're going to look at. We're not even looking at the requirements and sorting through who does what. What is it? It's a discussion Jonathan can tell you we've had with him. It's our next phase. But let me just ask the team again. Collecting complaints for the sake of data and mining data is one thing, but what do we do with the next step of complaint? I know Steve, you said you don't want to go there. I need to go there because the consumers will look at compliance. You're asking me. You don't care. What are you doing with it? So we need to understand the full process. And I'm not saying that to delay anything. Adding dials to a screen, you and I mean, Jonathan's on the call, he's technical, so is Paul, so am I. Adding dials is one thing. But what is the process to manage all this stuff that we're adding? Is it just to be a pass-through to the registrar who is responsible to and has the relationship with the registrant to address those complaints? And we tell the complainant, your ticket has been forwarded to the registrar. Thank you for contacting us. Will they be happy with that? What is the level of consumer trust we're going to gain at that level? So I really ask the team, are there other sources of collecting this data? I'm not saying I don't want to do it, but for me to take on that responsibility, I need to have a clear understanding the next steps, and I want to make sure the community understands what we're doing with those next steps. And Steve, another thing to your point, you are absolutely correct. The internet is really archaic, old, and one of the requirements that we've heard from different community members is the ability to enter different types in one complaint, so we make the user experience more friendly. But again, it's not before Prague. After Prague, I'm going to look at the requirements for internet. And whether we use internet or not is also another question.
Steve?
Yeah, thanks. And given that Maggie's dealing with a much bigger picture, and it doesn't sound as if it's worth trying to press Maggie and her department to commit to be able to collect 4 additional pieces of data or to commit to do the investigation and categorization necessary to determine, you know, whether it's a registry and registrar problem. Because as Rosemary indicated, you don't want the complainant to have to guess which structural element came up with it. That's something that has to be determined by a compliance person who looks at the nature of the complaint and then looks at the domain name upon which it was reported. And the experts at ICANN can determine rather quickly how to categorize that. And I realize that collection and categorization are way short of the third step, which is resolution. And I know, Maggie, you're focused on resolution because you can't be successful without doing resolution, and I understand that. But we can't be successful with this working group if we don't get into collection and categorization, because that's as far as we take it
right. For
purpose of advice. Our advice will probably be nearly done by the time you look at the internet form and decide whether you can add these 4 elements. So I would propose to the working group, we don't need to trouble Maggie with this right now.
Yep.
All we have to do is to record in our advice the kinds of items that we want ICANN to collect from the complainant and the kind of information that we expect ICANN to categorize once it does a little bit of preliminary investigation of the complaints. And that way, if the board adopts our advice sometimes later this summer, that'll dovetail neatly into whatever it is Maggie's doing at that time to design her database and her new forms.
Yep.
So we don't need commitment from Maggie on this call. It's really a courtesy to give her some advice, and then we're going to proceed.
Yeah, it really is a heads up. That's Cheryl for the record, and I think we've given Maggie the heads up now, so we've got other things we probably need to dive into.
Rosemary here. I'd like to make 2 points in response to that. I think we need to be careful, and this is just me, and it's the way I always look at things, and Cheryl will confirm this. But I think we need to be careful that we don't become satisfied being lost in the long grass of data collection. I think in this conversation what has been raised is a very fundamental issue that needs consideration at the highest level of ICANN, which is whether our compliance effort goes beyond contract compliance. And this is a very loose construction of this idea, goes beyond contract compliance to compliance with the affirmation of commitments, so compliance with philosophical and policy positions that the organisation is taking, way beyond elements of contract. So that to me is a fundamental question and needs a lot more deliberation than we can provide, and it perhaps is out of scope, I'm not sure, because we've been tasked with looking at words in the affirmation of commitments rather than words in the contract. But we must not lose that important concept, conceptual discussion, in my view, by being prepared to say, really what we want is a bit more data to be collected. That question of why the compliance team does what it does, I think, is very important. the second important point for me is that looking through the comments that have come in our public review period, we could, I mean, the danger that we run is that we're going to wind up with 500 things being measured and collected. And I think we're going to just have to think through our position. Up until now, we've always taken a position that, as I described earlier, I guess, that, you know, it's one thing having a wish list of data, and I'm not suggesting that we ought not widen the conversation, but to have a wish list of data that we know either cannot be collected or be reported, I think is a... It's something we as a working group need to discuss. And I'm not suggesting that we only confine ourselves to what is currently available and can be collected and reported. But the other end of the spectrum is starting to worry me as I look through the public comments period. So, goodness, there endeth the lesson, I guess. Now, when I look in the chat...
Cheryl here, and you... Your first point, I think the second point is something that as a work group, as we go through our public comments, what we need to do is make sure we don't get lost into a huge quagmire of data for data's sake, which the cry for which is probably more a reflection of some consternation and concerns that some parts of the community have in the current system, and what we're supposed to do is come up with metrics which can compare the current system to the future system after go-live. Look, you know very well, having worked with me for enough years, that the core set of value points you were just outlining in the first place are very, very important. But it is, in my view, out of scope for this work group, in as much as that's probably some of the core issues that will be teased out with the affirmation of commitment review team that get triggered 12 months after the new GTLDs are inserted into the route, and their data, what they interpret out of their data and the metrics that they use, is very much going to be focused on those all absolutely important issues. What we've been tasked to do, however, is to come up with the definitions for those metrics to even be looked at in the first place, and to have some pre and post benchmark and what happens 12 months, 2 years, 3 years out, comparative measurements. And I think to that end, we probably need to just realise that there's stuff that's likely to be tweaked and possibly able to be collected to meet those needs in the future, or not. But, you know, the job will be for ICANN to get the data from where it gets it, be it third party, external or internal. I guess kind of is up to them. We've got to get the definitions and the requirements and the measure marks right.
Thanks, Cheryl. That was great. Now, can I look at the chat? Sorry.
Rosemary?
Yes, Maggie?
May I... I'm sorry, I need to drop off in a couple of minutes, but I do want to let the entire team know. I heard the type of data you're looking for. I hear the type of information you're interested in. And what I would like to tell you is I will consider those when we are, after Prague, come back to revisit what is Internic about and what's being captured. And I will work with Barry to keep you informed on the progress in those phases. I know it does not meet your current timeline, but listening to the needs to help strengthen consumer trust is very important to me, but not just as a head of compliance, but as an ICANN community member too. So I just wanted to assure you of that, and I will look into it. It's just the timing is not right now, and I apologize for that.
Oh, that is what it is.
Thanks for that, Maggie. And the other matter, which is to have a look at some of the issues we've raised in our work so far and whether those issues can be currently addressed with compliance team data. Are you able to take that on board and come back to us in a week or so?
How many issues are there? I don't have the list in front of me. And are those issues kind of like ready for us to look at them? My understanding from previous conversations that you are sorting through them to identify what kind of like kind of filter through those issues. Do you want us to take a look at what's on the list now? Is that ready for us to review?
Rosemary here. My suggestion, pardon me, is that we do ask you to have a look at what's on the current list, and I think it was page 8 Dave was referring us to, because that would be very helpful. And then if there are other matters that arise through our reviewing of the public comments, then we could feed those to you through Berry. So perhaps if we do it that way, we'll be able to make some progress within a time frame that gets us to our end point, which is something reasonably completed by the middle of June.
Okay. So
Our page 8 was already a foundation set. They may be tweaked, and in some cases one or two additions be made as a result of the public comment input, but they do sit as a foundation set.
Okay, so yes, to answer your question, I will look at page 8, and if requiring additional clarification, will Barry be our point of contact?
I'll say yes, and I'm hoping Barry will confirm that.
Thank you, Barry.
Okay. So Barry, I would Paul and I will look at page 8 and regroup and get back with you by end of next week.
Great. Thank you, Maggie.
Thanks very much, Maggie.
If there are no further questions, may I be dismissed, please? Sorry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys. And I want you to know I am listening, and I will make it happen as much as I can.
Thank you, Maggie.
Thanks, Maggie.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Maggie. See you in Prague. Rosemary, I'm not online because my server is down, and I'll be buggered if it be between 5 and 6 in the morning. I'm going up to the office to reboot my ADSL router, so... I apologise for not being in the Adobe Connect room now.
Maggie, not only in Australia, Cheryl.
I'll make that apology.
All right. Well, perhaps if we move now to something that I'm sure will be far easier than that, and that's the draft letter. Perhaps if I could make just a slight introduction to this. When I got into the cold light of day and started thinking about the task, I actually got myself quite confused about whether I was writing a letter for Stefan to send to the head of the GAC or I was writing a letter for Stefan to send to the board. So in the end, I did a version which I think can be changed slightly. But in the essence, the body of the letter works, I think, in both instances. Then I had some extremely helpful feedback from John Berard, and that's the feedback that you can see on the screen in the blue. So let me just table the letter and ask for any comments.
Hey, thanks, Rosemary. I agree that it's a letter from GNSO and to the GAC, and I agree that how you've referenced the underlying GAC interest, you've referenced the affirmation as well as the board resolution. I do think, though, the second paragraph on the dates of the comment period can be simplified because May 8th is come and gone, and the reply comment period is also over. Thanks.
Okay. We just indicate that it was a reply comment period continued until the 8th of May. Are there any other comments from anybody? If not, then I'll make that little change and
Now, now it's a procedural question from me. Do I send this letter as chair of the working group to Stefan? And I think we're not proceeding with the Stefan to the board letter. So, let me
Rosemary, it's Steve, and I was the one you guys had tasked with reaching out to Bruce Tonk, and it was Bruce Tonk, and I said to Bruce, would you please try to prompt the GAC to take a look at what we've done and for the GAC to frame its comments maybe around our draft advice instead of starting from scratch later on. And it was Bruce Tonka's advice to get GNSO's chair to send a letter to the GAC, and I think what you've got here is perfect for that, and I would recommend that you send it to Stefan and copy your whole working group and remind Stefan this is picking up on Bruce Tonka's recommendation of having Stefan get it to the GAC as soon as possible. And I do think you should link to the advice letter, the draft advice, but remind them that a new version will be coming soon.
Yep. And in fact, I think on the third page, there's a little background area. Those links aren't live in this version, but they're all there. That's just up on the screen now. So I'll do the little intro reminding Stefan about Bruce's input on all of this and send that when we finish the call. Okay. Thank you for that. So that takes us back to our review of public comments. And I'm hoping that Barry can remember where we were.
Yes, Rosemary, this is Barry. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the call, I was not able to import the USG comments into here yet, so those are in a separate document. And the other change that you'll see is that our comments and our response and any proposed recommended action from the Costa Rica session have also been included in here. So where we left off from our last call, we had made it through consumer, and we made it through consumer trust definition, and we can see our recommended actions there.
Yep.
And there is one comment left from Costa Rica from Ray Fassett that we should maybe consider just to close out the consumer trust definition section. But if you'll allow, we don't have to do it now because obviously there will be additional entries coming from the USG. So to pick up where we left off from our last session was the first element with respect to consumer trust metrics and the INTA comment. In the recommended action section is a draft of a possible change to our definition, I'm sorry, for one of the metrics that are listed there, and that's where we left off.
Okay. So, and is it the highlighted, Barry, Rosemary here, is it the area that's highlighted in red that we just need to come back to before moving on?
The one area highlighted in yellow, which I believe was Olivier's recommendation that we include the at least measure experiences, and as well as then there was from the INTA, there was a suggestion that we get into the granular detail of registrant experience with regard to cyber squatting, and it sounded like we wanted to shave off some of the details with that and make it a more general statement instead of narrowing down with the inclusion of trademark owners, the reference to cyber squatting, etc.
Yep, that's right. It's all flooding back to me now.
And
thanks,
then,
Barry.
And one last thing, we were proposing adding a findings annex that would provide more details if we thought that needed to be required.
Okay. Right. So so the first thing for us to do on this call is just to have a look at the suggested text in regard to the cyber squatting, which raises, it takes us back to that discussion about whether to get very specific about trademark owners as one form of registrant, or whether to move, as we have done in the yellow highlighted text, to the broader formation of registrant experience. So are there any views on that? Olivier?
Thank you, Rosemary. It's Olivier for the transcript. I actually followed up on my self-appointed action item last time, which was to ask the at-large advisory committee what their point of view was on having intellectual property right owners as being a special type of registrant. And the response was not very positive.
It was resounding, though.
I'm coming into that. I thought there was going to be some understanding from some members of our community, but it appears that they just turned out and said no. They just have to be like everyone else, and there's nothing special about them.
Mm-hmm. So that would mean that we go with the construction of registrant experience, knowing that a particular self-identified group of registrants, in fact trademark owners, if they are not having a good experience, will let us know. So any other comments on that? In general terms, I think it's better to go for the broader construction myself. If not, then...
Yes, this is Michael Graham. I'm just for the transcript. I wondered, and I do not recall the conversation, so I will phrase this as a question. Do we want to limit this as registrant experience, or should this be registrant and internet user experience?
It should be the latter.
Should be the latter, yes. You're right.
Okay, and I think that addresses too, Olivier. Everyone is their own special interest group when it comes to being an internet user, so that would cover everyone, I believe.
Rosemary, that was a good catch, Michael. So, in fact, now we could move, pardon me, to the next item, I think, Barry.
Just one more question. So, with respect to how we display the definition within the advice letter, will we stop at the wording of before the GTLD expansion, and then the survey could at least measure experiences with everything that we've mentioned, including internet user, down in the findings annex, or do we want to keep them as one measure within the advice letter?
So let me understand what you're suggesting. So the suggestion is in the advice letter, we stop with the first sentence, really. Survey of perceived consumer trust in DNS relative to experiences before the GTLD expansion, full stop. And then the suggestion, as I'm understanding it, is that the detail of what the survey could at least measure goes into the findings annex. Is that the suggestion, Barry?
That's what I kind of recall from our last meeting, but of course this is a working group decision.
Sure. Yes. No, I was just getting clarification. Steve?
Hey, thanks, Rosemary. As Barry indicated earlier in the call, I mean, he along with the rest of us have probably read the U.S. government comments, and I brought up some of that when we had Maggie on the phone with respect to four additional metrics to capture. But we have already sort of skated past the consumer trust definition section. It's right in the table just before the beginning of the consumer trust metrics. And I wanted to point out that the consumer trust definition was subject to a pretty significant change request in the U.S. government's comment. They wanted to expand. They left what we had, right? But they expanded with an extra two sentences, raising the sort of magnitude of what we would measure in the definition of consumer trust. And all of you have access to that. As Barry said, it wasn't trivial to cut and paste that because it comes from a PDF.
Yeah.
But we're about to depart from the definition of consumer trust, but at some point we will have to come back and address whether we're going to accept any of the modifications that the USG had recommended. For my own part, I think their recommendations are pretty good, except for where they delve into this notion of determining costs and benefits, because I believe that's a little bit beyond the scope of the affirmation and the review to actually try to quantify costs and benefits. But I do think that they made some constructive suggestions about consumer trust reflecting the confidence that Internet users have in the overall DNS and in registry operators and registrars' efforts to curtail abuse, including respect for IP rights. Michael Graham should like that. Avoidance of fraud, crime, or other illegal conduct, as well as confidence in ICANN's ability to enforce requirements imposed on registrars and registry operators. So I think some of what they suggested most of us will find acceptable, but we have to put a bookmark at least to consider that probably on our next call.
Rosemary here. Yes, I was thinking about this before we started the call, about whether we should just go right back to the beginning, now that we've got the US government views on things, and incorporate that as we go. But taking account of Barry's point about the the difficulty just because of the mechanics of the document, my own thinking is that we should just press ahead, bearing in mind that we will have to come back and do the whole thing again, if you know what I mean, because of the substantive nature of these comments. By the time we're doing that, we may have an indication from the GAC about their processes as well. But I think the only way we can complete the task in the time frame is to deal with all the other public comments that we've got in our tool, knowing that when we've done that, we've then got to come back and look at these US government comments. So let's just make sure that we're all happy with that as a process over the next few weeks. Are there any comments on that way forward? Okay, thanks. So that would mean then we just press ahead through all of these suggested comments, knowing there's a big bookmark on the page that when we've done that, we go back and do it again, if you like, with the US government and any other GAC member comments that we may have received. Okay, so I think we go ahead now, Barry.
Okay, thank you. So just to clarify again about the proposed change to the definition, is it acceptable by the working group that the survey could at least measure experiences, et cetera, go into the findings index, or do we still keep this as one definition for now, as one whole definition?
This is Michael for the transcript, Michael Graham. I think my recollection was when we were discussing putting some of this information into the findings annex, it was when we were getting into the point of creating quite a substantial list of possible considerations, whereas the list as I read them here in the possible revision up until the red highlighting would be quite reasonable and seems to be a clarification and amplification of what is said in that first sentence. And I believe that if that were moved to a finding annex, the first sentence on its own does not provide sufficient information to make this a meaningful proposal.
Okay. So that would mean that we leave the expanded version in the advice letter. Any other views on that? If not, then let's go with that position that we leave all of it in the advice letter. Thanks, Barry.
Okay, our next comment is from Inta as well, and they were suggesting another change with respect to the relative incidence of notices issued to a registry operator for contract or policy compliance matters, and the second relative incidence of breach notices issued to registrars for contract or policy compliance measures. Their comment was lower than incidence in legacy GPLDs is far too low a bar for a target. This assumes that any improvement over legacy GPLDs is a success. For each of these metrics, the target should be a stated percentage lower than the legacy GPLDs. And this is with respect to page 7 of our advice letter, metrics number 6 and 7.
Rosemary here. This was certainly an issue we worked over, whether and if so, what numbers to associate with these metrics. Are there any reactions to the suggestion that we include a stated percentage, such as 50% lower? So I think I'm getting a Jonathan. Jonathan, you wanted to make
sorry,
a comment?
Sorry, I was on mute. I'm definitely philosophically inclined to agree with trying to come up with those numbers, and probably by setting a number in there, that can be a point of debate as this advice is made about whether that's the right number. But I think as a working group, it behooves us to frame the question as a more concrete number in order to make the debate about what's the right number rather than accepting the idea that just a relative change equates to a success.
So, Jonathan, have you got a suggestion about the number? Because I agree with the principle, but I always just get stuck at whether the number should be 20%, 50%, 30%.
Well, and again, I mean, my overall concern, if I can just take a step back from that question, is that that this working group makes the perfect the enemy of the good. I think we have very low likelihood of producing some report that no one's going to object to any of the numbers in. And so I'm perfectly happy throwing a number out like 50% and then letting that be a topic for discussion once we've published this advice. I mean, let's make that the debate. I mean, the growth that will represent for ICANN as an organization, if we're having a debate about whether the decrease should be 30% or 50%, will be amazing. So, I mean, I say let's say 50%, I'm less worried about defending that number.
Yes, okay.
Let's
good.
Just have the discussion in real time as opposed to trying so hard to anticipate what will be acceptable to the community. And I guess
good.
I'm going to say that frequently. I mean, I think we're trying to provide a framework for having these discussions.
Yeah.
And that ultimately, no matter what numbers we put, we're going to end up discussing the specifics of them.
Okay, that's a good point. Steve?
Yeah, thanks, Rosemary. To Jonathan Zook's point, Let's put this in terms of real numbers. Does anybody know how many breach notices ICANN issued last year? Is it on the order of 10, on the order of 100, on the order of 1,000?
Tens, I'd have thought. No, 10. I don't think it went down to 10.
Yeah, it's very, very low.
Yeah.
And in that respect, if it was 10 last year, and then in the new year we have 1,000 GTLDs instead of just 20, would we really expect there to be only 5 breach notices? No, it's all about relative incidents. So if there were 10 breach notices last year for 20 GTLDs, we're saying that the relative incidents, so it's a function of the total, and if we had 1,000 new GTLDs in the route, the rate of 10 out of 20 would say 500. And at 499, they'd be lower than the relative incidents, you know, of the legacy GTLDs last year. Well, I have a feeling that 499 breach notices out of 1,000 new GTLDs will not be perceived as success at achieving consumer trust. That would be a disaster, right? So I'm just running through the actual numbers and thinking that, and Barry, you just answered, you think it's roughly 14, right? Okay. So it's still in the order of 10. So I think that I'm starting to come around to Michael Graham's point of view that we ought to set it to be significantly lower than the relative incidents in the legacy GTLD space, because it's a relatively low number of complaints, but it's spread amongst just 20 GTLDs. Now, Barry, is it possible that of the 14 breach notices, they were focused or concentrated on just a few GTLDs as opposed to scattered among the 20 that we have?
This is Barry. If I'm reading this correctly, this is only within the scope of registrar compliance breach notices. I don't believe outside of the .jobs thing there was anything registry-oriented.
Got it. And when you measure registrars, if there were 14, let's suppose there was 13 of them, because one of them was the .jobs. So 13 were registrars. There's roughly 800 registrars in the legacy space. So 14 is not relative to 20. 14 is relative to 800 registrars. Isn't that the correct percentage?
Yes, and the number is actually about 900, but...
Okay, so 14 point well taken. Out of 900, or something in the neighborhood of 14%. 14 out of a 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
1.4%, excuse me. So, Michael Graham, let me ask you then. So, given the real numbers that we have, that it looks like 1 out of 20 with legacy registries, 14 out of 1,000 for the registrars, the 50% cut would be significantly low. I mean, it would be very tiny percentages.
Yeah, this is Michael. I don't know the answer, and I don't have the advantage of having been involved in the earlier discussion of what it should be. Two things. One, I think what you were saying, Steve, is correct, that this should be stated in terms of relative incidents rather than absolute incidents, because there's no way it would be a dream for it to be lower incidents pure number. As to what would be the appropriate number, 50% lower, 30% lower, the sort of fallback that I could think of would be if we suggested in the advice that it should be substantially lower or significantly lower, and then to give as an example, which is what we were giving the INTA comment as an EG rather than an absolute figure, 50% lower, something that is a significant stated percentage, that's a real target to look at. And it's sort of hard to have a target where you don't have the history, but if we could utilize, we don't know what the effect is going to be. And so perhaps that is still the best way to express it, either substantially or significantly or some other term, rather than just lower, and then to suggest what might be a percentage to look at. As you say, it would be a tiny, tiny percentage, at least in the area of registries, one would hope. But we don't know what I think either the change in bringing in all of these new registries might have on that figure, which might be a dramatic change the wrong way.
If I could follow up, for registries, if it was 1 out of 20 last year, that's 5%. For registrars, if it was 14 out of 1,000, that's 1.5%.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so, and...
Right, so going to the new registries, that would be looking at the absolute change. Let's just say it's going from 20 to 2,000. That would be 100 incidents would be the same. So a 50% change would be 50 incidents out of 2,000.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an unrealistic figure to shoot for.
Yeah, it's not unreasonable. And on the registrar side, we may not see that many new registrars in the new GTLD space. For the most part, it's the existing registrars plus any new registrars that are spawned as a result of vertical ownership, particularly in the dot brands. And 1.5% on the registrar side may not change at all. That still might be in the neighborhood of 10 to 20 incidents.
Mm.
I'm amazed, Barry, that it's that low, the number of breach notices. That may reflect that compliance is doing a lousy job. I don't know. But for all the complaints we hear about registrars, to only have 14 complaints in an entire year, 14 breach notices in an entire year seems very surprising. So where are we now? We're on the point of whether to put a percentage in or to say words like significant reduction or leave it alone.
Jonathan, did you want to come back in at this point?
Sure. I mean, I guess part of the problem that we're facing here is that breach notices themselves are a function of what might be considered inadequate enforcement, right? I mean, as a measure, the 14 is probably not reflective of what probably should have been the situation under the current circumstances, and it's probably artificially low, which I think makes it difficult for us to come up with a number for this particular measure, because I think that the baseline from which we're trying to operate is probably not that valuable. You know, there probably should have been more breach notices.
And Rosemary, here it takes us back to that point that Maggie made earlier about different sorts of measurements at different points in the compliance process, and where our conversation is taking us right now is that we would want more breach notices as evidence that the whole compliance process is working, rather than a substantial decrease on what we're saying is an artificially low base. The other point that I just wanted to make was that in our discussions around these numbers previously, we kept having to remind ourselves that not only do we make a comment in our draft advice about measures or metrics, there is that issue of the targets over 3 years. So it's perhaps at that point, you know, over 3 years, you want this particular metric to be 50% lower than current incidents. That's just by way of example of reminding us that we have that complication in our consideration of all of this as well, that we've got three-year targets to be thinking about. So I think on this one, are we saying that we will stick with relative incidents? Now, where's Michael's construction? Oh, rather than have 50% significantly lower. But then if we think we've got an artificial floor in the first place, then significantly lower is not what we want. Perhaps if I stop talking
Rosemary,
and ask for comment, yes.
Yeah, Rosemary, this is Steve. Remember that this is not a comparison to 2011. This is a comparison, a contemporary comparison. The way we've written it on page 7 of our table was that you'd get the third year out and you would compare 2015, the year 2015, look at the relative incidents in the new GTLDs, and we said that the new GTLDs should be lower than the same year incidents in legacy GTLDs that are operating in 2015. So if, in fact, compliance is issuing a lot more breach notices, they would be doing so on both new and legacies. And the artificial floor will have ceased to become an issue because we're not looking back to 2011. We're looking concurrently between the new and the legacy.
Yes.
and cut the knot here, I would recommend, rather than a 50%, I'd recommend saying significantly lower. And, of course, we're going to keep it relative. That's always been our intention.
Okay, so do we have consensus then around significantly lower rather than an actual number? Oh, I think we're doing affirmation by silence. Jonathan,
yep.
Do you mean to have your hand up at this point? Oh, okay.
This is Michael. I mean, it would be good to have some figure if the group thinks that significantly lower is something that still retains meaningfulness. I would agree with it.
I think that with the picks in ND box, I think we've got a position on significantly lower without the number. Have I captured that correctly? I think so. Okay. So we'll go with significantly lower. So we can go move to the next point. Thanks, Barry.
Okay, great. This comment is also by Inta. With respect to the relative incidence of UDRB complaints before and after expansion, it referred to seeing the bub, which I think was kind of the same logic, but also may need to aggregate with the URS or report both separately in the aggregate to compare apples with apples, since the availability of the URS is intended to reduce the quantity of UDRP cases, even where problems are at a same or higher level. Relative incidence should be calculated by the total number of UDRP or similar domain name proceedings, ergo UDRPs filed in the legacy GTLDs from January 1st, 2000, over the total number of domain name registrations registered in the legacy GTLDs from January 1st of 2000.
Rosemary here. Before we take discussion on that point, if I could just make a general point. I thought it was very instructive in discussing the last point when we actually pulled the numbers, the current numbers out. It makes the discussion much more concrete. So I was wondering whether we could ask Barry where ICANN does have numbers for the metrics that we're suggesting, whether they could be included in the comment box, so that as we go through the rest of the tool, we've got those numbers before us. Or is that a mission impossible task, Barry?
This is Barry. When we start getting into these, probably closer to mission impossible, and there's two slices to this pie. One, we have all of the UDRP providers out there, which are three or four or five, I can't remember the last count. They have their data for the quantity of UDRP complaints filed, whereas the only thing that I believe ICANN has access to is if a UDRP complaint is won and the domain doesn't get transferred, ICANN then typically would receive an inbound complaint stating that the domain was not transferred. And those numbers certainly, I don't believe, will relate to the significant numbers across the UDRP landscape. So in terms of getting access to those as easily as I did with the breach notices is going to be much more difficult.
Okay. Thanks for that. But in general terms, if there is a metric where it's easy, as with the breach notices, to get the number, if you could do that for us, I think that would help our discussions. Steve?
Okay. Rosemary, Steve. Michael makes a compelling point that the URS is designed to be a substitute for UDRP.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, if you just counted UDRPs in the new versus the legacies, you might conclude that the new is performing better when, in fact, the URSs are absorbing a lot of cyber squatting. So, Michael, I am convinced that you're right, that we need to include URS and UDRP. And this is not a look back, so I don't buy the stuff about going back to a date. This is a contemporary comparison in the year of management. So you would say 2015, you'd count the number of total URS and UDRPs in the new space as a percentage of the total domains, and then you would compare that to the total UDRPs in the legacy GTLDs as a percentage of their domains. There won't be a URS in the, well, there won't likely be a URS available in the legacy GTLDs. I think you understand that it's only available in the new. So I would agree with Michael that we should combine URS and UDRP, but we don't need to get into the stuff about looking back to the year 2000, since this is a contemporary comparison, new versus legacy, and we don't look back.
Steve, it's Michael for the record. I'm looking at the bottom of page 7, however, and it's the relative incidence of UDRP decisions against registrant for and after expansion. So that would take into account the current numbers, I believe.
Yeah, the words before and after expansion, this is nothing you could not have known. Those words were something we had been using frequently to try to focus everybody's attention on comparing the expanded TLDs to the old ones. But if you read across to the fourth column in that table, the way that we proposed the three-year target was that it'd be lower than the incidence in legacy GTLDs. And whenever we wrote it that way, that is always a current year comparison. Now, on the next page, on page 8, you'll see that we do say that there ought to be a declining incidence in URS complaints over time, right? Declining incidence from year 2 to 3. So the definition of the words before and after expansion is unintentionally misleading. It might lead you to believe that we're proposing metrics that measure changes over time there. But the way the metric is described in column 4, it was a simple contemporary comparison between the new and the legacy space at any given point in time.
That perhaps takes us to a clarification, does it, of our document?
A clarification and a complication, I believe, because I think the INTA comments were taking that, as you well point out, Steve, as meaning looking at the current situation in terms of UDRP complaints within the legacy, and this is why the formula was created that they were looking at. And then looking down the line, 1 year, 3 years, at the relative incidence of UDRP and URS decisions and complaints, the idea being that if consumer trust is being enhanced, then the number of these complaints and cyber squatting type of issues to the INTA constituency, at least, should be going down, and that would increase their trust, certainly, in the system. And also, they believe, consumers' trust. So with your explanation, I'd have to go back and take a look at this again to see, I believe what it would mean from the INTA perspective would be that perhaps at least one or more relative incidents before and after the expansion would be appropriate to demonstrate whether or not the expansion did satisfy, you know, the AOC in creating increased consumer trust in as to this type of intellectual property.
Yeah, Michael, this is Steve. It'd be great if you could do that, because we did constrain ourselves to measuring the expansion by understanding how well the expanded GTLDs performed, not the legacy GTLDs. So the trick was how to compare, and 3 years out, I mean, I would just ask you to ask INTA, 3 years out, if the relative incidence of, and I'm accepting your point that it's URS plus UDRP, if the relative incidence of URS and UDRP complaints and findings in the 2000 new GTLDs is lower than the contemporary incidence in the 20 Gs, I would be amazed. Let me explain why. this is a relative incidence, not as a relative to the total number of GTLDs, but the relative incidence measured on domains. So there are hundreds of millions of domains in the legacy GTLDs, and there probably still will be by 2015. And so you divide the total number of UDRP complaints in the legacy GTLDs, you divide it by 800 million domain names, you get a very tiny low number. And our goal is that in 2015, the relative incidence of URS and UDRPs in the new GTLDs be actually lower than that. And since the new GTLDs are in ramp-up stage, as people are out there buying new domain names, there may be genuine mistaken cyber squatting that gives rise to URS and UDRP because people are buying lots of new names as they ramp up. So I realize you have to take each one of these rows in and of itself and you analyze it carefully. I think there's a pretty good chance that if the new GTLDs came in with a lower relative incidence, that would be pretty heroic. Thanks.
Steve, Michael again, thank you for that explanation. I think you're making it very clear. And just so that I am clear, and I will go back and review this with the committee, the real measure, as you're expressing it, is at a particular point in time, the relational number that is occurring within the new GTLDs as opposed to the relational numbers occurring at that time in the legacy GTLDs, correct?
You got it. And the relational, the denominator, is the domains, not the GTLDs.
Rosemary here. So I think perhaps if we split this into two, we take the point now that we're needing to include URS as well as UDRP, and we're leaving Michael to confirm with his group that the measure, the relative incidence that we're proposing meets the need. Have I got that right?
I think so.
Okay.
Yes,
but I did want to record and see if anyone else agrees that Michael's first point is that URSs are substitutes for UDRPs, and I would hope that our working group can agree with Michael on that we ought to be combining them on the bottom of page 7, URS plus UDRP in parentheses rather than just UDRP.
Well, certainly from my point of view, I thought that was an important point. Tobias?
Yes, maybe I'm misunderstanding something there, but is there a possibility that someone would launch both a UDRP and a URS? That would be a URS first and then a UDRP later? In the same case, because in the URS you can get the suspension.
Mm-hmm.
So the domain name is only suspended, isn't it? So as a rights holder, I would probably first go for a URS to suspend the domain name and have a quick solution for the problem. And then afterwards, if that's not enough, go for a UDRP. But perhaps I'm misunderstood. Thanks.
This is Michael. Olivier, it's possible, I suppose. The problem is that really the two types of procedures are addressing different things, and winning a URS may prevent you from being able to succeed in a UDRP insofar as you're no longer using the domain name in bad faith since it's been suspended. So I think it would be quite rare that you would have both of those proceedings against the same mark, same domain name. I suppose it's possible, but it would be difficult to foretell at this point, and it's certainly not something that I understand has been anticipated in the domain name enforcement community.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Tobias. So we've got consensus, I believe, on broadening this point to relative incidence of URS and UDRP complaints. To pick up the INTA's comment, we should combine those two.
Right, and we might well need to strip off the words before and after expansion. I believe that is a relic, and it is confusing because it doesn't match the way we've designed our 3-year target.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the second point. So we take out before and after expansion, and then we're just leaving the further discussion about the legacy GTLDs with Michael to come back to us.
That's right, and it also highlights that when we said the word relative incidence, we explained this in our document back on one of the earlier pages, that relative incidence is sometimes relative to the total number of registrations, and sometimes it's to the total number of registrars, contract parties, and sometimes relative to the total number of registries.
Yeah.
And we ought to clarify that. It's pretty self-evident when you look at the metric. For instance, breach notices don't have to do with registrations. They have to do with the parties running things. So you look at registrars or you look at registries. But things like UDRP and URS are more to do with the actual registrant population. They're the ones that are squatting. So I think we probably ought to clarify, I think Barry knows what I'm talking about, each one of these rows when we say relative, we probably need to clarify relative to total registrations or relative to registrars or relative to registries.
So let me just check. Firstly, we've got consensus on that. I think we do. And now let me go to Barry and just ask Barry, are you clear, Barry, on what we're asking you to do on these points?
I think so. Let me attempt to summarize. And I think this really accomplishes number 13, 14, and 15 of these comments. But if I understand correctly, that A, we're going to combine UDRP, the relative incidence of UDRP and URS complaints. We will remove before and after expansion, but the end state to this will be instead of 4 specific metrics as we have in our advice letter now, it will be consolidated into 2. And the difference between them will be the relative incidence of UDRP and URS complaints versus relative incidence of UDRP and URS decisions against a registrant.
I think so, Barry, but we may well leave some rows in there if they measure the decline over time. But I catch your point. There were 2 rows in there that said URS complaints declining over time, but that doesn't work anymore since sometimes URS could be substitutes for UDRP and the decline could just be because the URS isn't working anymore so, as opposed to being effective.
Yeah.
So, folks, Barry's talking about the fact that on page 8, the third and fourth rows of our own advice letter on page 8 may need to come out or be changed to be URS plus UDRP declining over time.
Yeah. So that raises a question. Pardon me. Barry, is it possible for you to capture changes that relate to page 8 in a document as we go through, so that we can make sure that the front of our advice letter and the back of it are actually coherent?
This is Barry. I am capturing what changes we will be making to the advice letter within column 4 and specifically calling out the task. Up to this point, I haven't been making those changes to the latest version of the advice letter itself.
Okay. All right, well, we just all should be mindful that at some point we've got to look at the whole document to make sure that it's coherent from in all its parts as various things, you know, track through definitions to metrics to targets and so on. Okay, I think we can move on to the next point, which is 16, I think. Done 13, 14, 15...
Yes, and Rosemary, just so our 5th June session will be exactly what you just discussed. We'll have the exercise where we'll have the latest draft advice letter with the track changes as correlated with the agreed-to changes from our public comment matrix so that we're aligned and make sure we got all of our changes covered.
Right. Okay, so the next point.
And so just so that's clear, again, 13, 14, and 15 were all combined together, so we're moving on to 16, again by INTA. And this may be a quick one as well, but these were specific type changes. UDRP and URS do not capture a large part of the contentious matters involving domain names. We therefore believe an accurate measurement of conflicts due to the new GTLD program should include this measure as well as that for UDRP and URS. And I think these were actually, this is a new proposed metric. Again, the quantity and relative incidence of litigation complaints. The source is litigants and/or survey provider. The difficulty is moderately difficult as it would require self-reporting. In addition, or in the alternative, information could be gathered by a survey.
Thanks, Barry. Are there any comments about this point?
This is Steve. Could I ask Michael to educate us all about the likelihood that we would be able to get that self-reported data as well as any risks that the self-reporting would be accurate?
This is Michael. Yes, Steve. I believe the likelihood would be high that we would be able to get this information at least from the INTA community. The accuracy of that information, unfortunately, would be limited by the fact that non-members may or may not report this information. There are a few, but extremely few, organizations that track litigation across the world, which makes it very difficult outside of INTA or one of the other international organizations to obtain this information.
And Michael, what percentage of the time do your members file complaints without also doing a UDRP?
I don't have a good figure for that, but if it's considered to be a trademark infringement, in certain cases with my clients at least, we would go that direction rather than the UDRP because that only solves part of the problem. But it is possible, and so this type of litigation either, and to back up a bit, since the very first days of the UDRP, the comparison within the intellectual property rights community has been, do I file a UDRP or do I file an ACPA, which would be an anti-cyber squatting litigation? And both types of cases have been applied in different types of situations. And so the feeling from INTA was that in order to measure the effectiveness in terms of trust, we're looking at the UDRP and URS systems and using those figures to determine whether or not it's a more trustworthy environment. But at the same time, if we ignore or do not consider the number and relative size of litigation arising from and relating to these new domains, we are not having a complete picture of the trustworthiness of the environment.
Rosemary, may I just add one final thought?
Sure, Steve.
Yes, the good news is this is number 16, 17, 18, and 19, so we can group all these together.
Yes.
And I concur with Michael Graham that if there are trademark actions taking place that are not captured by the UDRP URS statistics, that ideally we'd love to have that.
Mm.
And if Michael can propose a mechanism by which ICANN could learn with some amount of reliability the amount of litigation that's brought, mm-hmm. and that we could measure it every year, once a year. Maybe INTA and other groups could even propose a way of doing the survey themselves and turn that data over to ICANN. That I'm persuaded that if we can come up with a plan to get the data, then I would be in support of adding metrics to this effect. But I would also ask Michael, what kind of a goal do you have on this? Is it a decline, or are we measuring it relative to the G's at the same time?
This is Michael again. Steve, thank you. It would be relative. It would not be an absolute number. So what we would be looking for is a relational decrease in the number of conflicts that are arising within the domain name space as a result of the expansion. And I am certainly, you know, having raised this issue, I am certainly happy to go back to INTA and discuss with that committee whether or not there are some means that we could suggest and that INTA and other organizations could be instrumental in putting together to put together this information. It would be useful not only for the ICANN community, I think, but also for the intellectual property owners community. And then one final thing, insofar as I was not involved in the drafting of these particular proposals, I think there's room within these four to combine them into perhaps one additional or maybe two additional metrics.
But complaints as well as adjudications,
right?
As opposed to having separate ones. And you weren't proposing combining them with URS and UDRP, but these were new rows in the metrics table, right?
These would be new rows, correct. So it would still look in the same way that we're going to be looking at the UDRP-URS processes, we'd be looking at this litigation process and make the same sort of comparisons. That would be the way I would view it.
Yeah, and I would say that if INTA can suggest the mechanism by which the data would be gathered, it really increases the likelihood that this gets accepted not only by the working group, but then also by the ACSOs and the board itself. And they don't have to have an answer on that right away. That answer might not come till June or July. But as long as it's there before the board sees it, they'll be able to understand that if they took your advice to add these metrics, they wouldn't be incurring a lot of extra costs to go out and learn what the data is.
Right. And what I would do, Steve and Rosemary, in that regard, is go back and at least be able to come back and in the source information be able early on to refer to, you know, it being developed within that community and then eventually, you know, have something firm that would be proposed.
Thanks, Michael. Rosemary here. So I think the action for these four, have I got this right, 16, 17, 18, and 19, is for Michael to come back to us with a combining of those so that we've got a new metric, which in a sense is taking us one step further in the compliance process, although I know there's an element of choice about not using the internal ICANN process but using external processes. But this is part of the ecosystem of consumer trust. So we firstly need that metric and then an indication of how the data could be collected. So for those four items, 16, 17, 18, and 19, if we can leave that with you, Michael, to come back to us.
Yes, and I will get together with my people, hopefully, and by next Tuesday. Are we having another call next Tuesday, or is it the 5th?
We are, yes.
Okay. Hopefully I'll be able to have answers on this and also the earlier questions on the UDRP by Tuesday.
Great.
Thank you. So now let's move to item 20.
Give me just a second. I'm trying to catch up on
that. That's okay, Barry. Yep. Yep.
Okay, the next metric is also by INTA. And this is the, with regard to our current metric on page 8, metric number 6, quantity of spam received by a honeypot email address in each new GTLD. The comment is lower than incidence in legacy GTLDs is too low of a bar for a target. This assumes that any improvement over legacy GTLDs is a success. For each of these metrics, the target should be stated percentage lower than the legacy GTLDs, 50% lower, noting that, assuming that there are honeypot email addresses in all legacy GTLDs.
This is Michael Graham for the transcript. And again, this is the 50% lower was a figure that we had come up with there. And the only real caveat that to ensure that it's a real number, that there are also honeypots in all of the legacy GTLDs. Thanks.
So have we got any comment from the working group on this suggestion? So the suggestion really, again, is that we actually put a number out there, I think.
Well, not a number, but a relative reduction, a percentage reduction, not an absolute quantity, right?
No. I'm thinking 50%. So we're saying relatively lower, 50%, for example, 50%.
Right, and this, Michael, again, this is pointing back to the earlier sections that we were talking about where we went with the language significantly lower.
Uh-huh.
And again, if there is a good figure that we could come up with, that would be tremendous. Otherwise, an indication that it needs to be something other than just lower in incidence. Thanks.
So perhaps if we take that suggestion that we make it our wording significantly lower, rather than try and determine a number, we could deal with this comment quite quickly. Any reaction to that suggestion that we include the language significantly lower in this item? Great. So I think we'll go with that, Barry. We've got a couple of ticks, good, more ticks by the moment. So if we change the language there to significantly lower, then we've got consensus on that one.
Great. I've got that captured. Move on to 21.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is a public comment from the Registry Stakeholder Group. With regard to the measures of consumer trust on page 7, the metric lower than incident in legacy GTLDs may not be realistic for determining relative incidence of notices issued to registry operators for contract or policy compliance measures. We believe that the incidence of notices for existing GTLDs has been quite low. We suspect, considering the large number of new players expected to enter the market for new GTLDs, that it might be reasonable to expect a higher incidence of such notices. A better metric might contain a range, ergo plus or minus 5% of legacy GTLDs. One way of examining this further would be to request that the actual incidence rates for existing GTLDs over the last few years, if it is extremely low as we suspect, using it might set an unreasonable, challenging expectation for new GTLDs. Also, the requirements for existing GTLDs are not the same as for new GTLDs, so at a minimum, any comparison done should note this in interpreting the results.
This is Steve, if I could get in the queue.
Yes, Steve, go.
I believe this came from the registries, and I believe Chuck Gomes mentioned it in Costa Rica as well. I think that the best thing to do is to explain, to go back to the registries, if we could, and tell them that, to answer their question, there was really only one breach notice out of 20 GTLDs in 2011. One out of 20 is 5%. And then ask them whether that 5% which could be, as Michael described earlier, as many as 100 notices in, you know, 2 years out, 3 years out, to ask the registry constituency whether they really think like 100 notices is an unreasonably low goal. Because it strikes me that that would not seem like an unreasonably low goal, 100. In fact, we might feel as if we have not delivered on consumer trust if we have something like 100 breach notices in the year 2015. And, I mean, is it appropriate for us, and Inta's on the call, so we're able to ask Michael to go back and get clarification. This is an incident where if Jonathan Robinson were on the call for the registries, we'd be able to put it to him and share that data and that perspective and see whether they would feel differently. How would we, I mean, if it was worth doing so, we could do a direct outreach, explain the data, and ask whether they still feel they want to go with a plus or minus 5%.
This is Michael in the queue. Steve, I wonder too, in reading this, if
you for a moment. Sorry, my phone battery is about to die, so I wonder if Steve would mind sharing the last few minutes. I'm sorry to jump over you, Michael.
Oh no.
Sure.
I'm just wondering if perhaps his comment too, in looking at the possibility because of the new GTLD registries coming online, the possibility that it actually would be a jump in numbers, it looks as though he's also reading that earlier statement in the metrics as meaning there's a comparison before and after, or this is, oh no, shouldn't be on that.
Yeah, it's possible, and we earlier considered changing ours to not just lower, but significantly lower, and the registries are saying here that it may not be lower because it's an artificially low number. But I really believe that the key here is a little bit of real data. And so, Barry, before we would make an official outreach to the registry constituency, could I just ask staff to verify in the years 2010 and 2011 how many notices were issued to the registries? And, you know, if it is in the neighborhood of 1 out of 20 registries in each of those years, I think that data could go a long way to clear this up. They actually asked that. Yeah, the last paragraph from the registry says, quote, one way of examining this further would be to request the actual incidence rate for existing GTLDs over the last few years. So let's answer that immediately and then use it to pivot off of where we go with this one. Barry, can we ask you to take that on?
Yes, I'm sorry. I've got it noted.
And Barry, earlier on the call, you pointed out that the dot jobs breach notice is something a lot of us knew about, and that's where we got the one in 2011. Does anybody on the call recall whether there were others in 2010?
Off of the top of my head, this Barry, I'm going to say no, but I need to confirm to be sure.
Okay. Because that makes the rate half as high. If it's really been 1 over 2 years, I know we're just measuring the annual rate, but in the year 2015, if the legacy GTLDs in the year 2015 has 0 breach notices, then you know what? It is impossible for the new GTLDs to meet that metric. And Michael Graham, if you're listening, you'll see the registries have a good point here. It's really hard to do better than 0. And the registries had 0 in 2010. They may well have 0 in 2012, 13, and 14. There's only 20 of them running. So it might be better for us to examine the historical data and come up with a number like no more than 5% of the new registry should have any complaints in any given year. Be another way to do it. Like Jonathan Zook just posted it in the chat. There you go. What are the folks on the call that are still with us? What do the folks think of instead of comparing it to the legacies, contemporarily setting a number like 5%, which was actually empirically derived. Thoughts on that?
This is Michael. I'd like to see those numbers again, just in case there was a change. And this would be 5% of the registrars.
Well, yeah, the registries in the case of registry breach notices, and registrars in the case of registrar notices. With the registrars, Michael, we think that the historical number is something in the neighborhood of 1.5%. And we're going to get the real data, but if it was 14 out of 900, it's about 1.5%.
Right. So plus or minus 5%. I mean, that would be a high increase over what it was, just based on what you were just saying, right?
No. When Chuck has plus or minus 5, I think you have to read that differently. That's not plus or minus 5 percentage points.
That's change.
That would be exactly. Plus or minus 5% above or below. So he's just trying to say the legacies should be in step with the legacies, and the new should be in step with each other. They should just be within plus or minus 5% of each other. We're proposing on the later part of this call looking at 2011 as the test year, getting the relative incidence rates from 2011 and baking them in to say that the new GTLDs ought to do better, maybe even significantly better than that. And if we did it this way, folks, we would remove this relative comparison in 2015 between the new and the legacies. It's a different way to go.
Yeah. This is Michael. I think I'd have to think about that 5%, how that works into that.
Well, we're no longer thinking about Chuck's plus or minus 5%. The 5% I gave you was the year 2011 had one breach out of 20 GTLDs. That's where the 5% comes from. I don't think that the registry's comment on plus or minus 5% would apply anymore if, in fact, we said the new guys had to be significantly lower than these two base rates of 5% for registries and 1.5% for registrars. You with me now, Michael?
Yeah, I think I see where you're going.
Yeah, the plus or minus 5% would go away because we're going to address the registry's challenge to get the actual data and bring it back. All right, now that brings us past our two-hour mark, and I think we have another 2 hours scheduled a week from today, same time. Barry, I know you have tons of work to do, and at least the first time around when we did the draft advice, the members of the working group took the pen a lot more, and we're willing to do that as well. You're currently managing a couple of documents for us. It's up to you to let us know whether you want working group members to take a more direct role between our calls every week.
Correct. And then, the help will be much appreciated. And I think how we can accomplish that is maybe at our next call, I will have the USG comments loaded in here, and we can start at the top and make sure that we cover the comments that we hadn't. And as we complete each section, then the working group can maybe pen the next version of the document.
All right, and we're up to 21 out of 67, so we're roughly a third of the way through the total number of items that you've flagged in your table. That's before adding USG.
Correct.
Okay, we've got a lot of work left to do. So if you come up with the right areas where you want to ask us to do editing, you know this group has been pretty hands-on.
Absolutely.
Okay. Hey, thanks, everyone, and especially the staff.
Jonathan has his hand raised.
Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, sorry. I know everybody's trying to leave, but I guess it's just something to think about. I guess I'm increasingly concerned about breach notices as a metric, as a measure of success, because I think particularly in the IP community, an increase in breach notices would be a hallmark of more aggressive contract enforcement and might lead to greater consumer trust if real action is taken against registries and registrars that are violating their contracts. I think the feeder data for number of complaints and then maybe some other measure of, people that have, as Maggie pointed out, people that have reached a certain phase a number of times and haven't received a breach notice or something like that, feels better than trying to ask for a decrease in breach notices. I think we might be creating the wrong incentive for the compliance team if one of our measures of success is that they never send any breach notices out.
Yeah, it's like the dilemma that you put more police on the street, they become a deterrent because criminals know they're watching. And the number of arrests typically go way down when there's vigilance. Your point is that the decline in arrests might be due to laziness and not vigilance.
That's right. And so there might be other numbers that better represent that there's more police or that complaints lead to breach notices, right, that process is working. It might be something better to measure than just that there was a decrease in breach notices because I don't know. I mean, it's a little cynical on my part, I guess, but if the program can be just a success in some measure because there aren't breach notices, then there'd be an incentive not to issue them.
Right, but of course, that's not the only measure, right? We discussed earlier on the call the complaints that come from the community at least have equal weight, and we're not putting all our eggs in the breach notice basket. It's important to note.
I'm sorry to do this last minute. Like I said, it's just sort of striking me that maybe maybe the number of breach notices itself is not helpful.
This is Tobias. If I just could jump in, I think I need to support Jonathan there. I felt this all the time. I thought that this was a bit strange. I think it's very useful to have the number of breach notices. But then in terms of interpreting the data later, whether you actually say this is an increase or decrease of consumer trust is rather difficult and needs to be tracked in combination with other measures. So perhaps one solution...
I guess I'm being even more cynical than that, which is that setting a target to decrease the relative number of breach notices, when in fact, at least for those of us in the IP community, would like to see the number of breach notices go up, feels like the wrong thing to put out there as a target for the compliance team.
Yes, so maybe my suggestion for, this is Tobias, for solving this would be that we take a closer look at the targets and look at areas where we maybe don't define any targets because it's not really meaningful. I have the same issue with competition, too. We can go back to that later. So basically, perhaps if we just look again at whether we actually want to define a target for the specific measure, that might be helpful because it might be very useful to collect the data, but it may be difficult to point out in advance whether the data will point in this or that direction, so we can't really set a meaningful target. Thanks.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Sorry. I firmly believe that we need to set measures for as many of these metrics as we can, and I'm trying to be very specific that in this case, a decrease, when in reality we're looking for an increase, is a very counterintuitive target. That's all.
Barry, would you note in the table for when we come back to this that for these two breach notice rows, that an alternative view is not to specify a target. And then you can even cite the reason. You don't want to create an incentive for lax enforcement. And that way the working group can consider that. It looks like we're going to keep the rows in the table. The only question is whether there's anything in the target column.
Yeah, Steve, it's Michael. Just very quickly, it sounds like this is a perfect sort of thing for the findings of fact type of attachment that Rosemary, I believe, was talking about insofar as we put this out as something to look at and to measure with a finding of fact notice that it is unclear from this distance whether or not an increased number means that it is a decreased amount of trust or increased amount of compliance enforcement, so that it may cut both ways, and we would therefore advise the review team to take into account not only the raw numbers but also the effectiveness of those programs.
Quite agree, but I wouldn't move it to some other part of the document. I mean, we're going to have things in the consumer trust and choice section for which we're asking for measures and we're suggesting they're important, but without suggesting a three-year target. I think burying it in some findings section ends up diminishing its importance when it's just as important as everything else in there.
Okay, as Michael, yes, I'd agree with that. As long as it's, you know, expressed, I think that addresses then, Jonathan, to the extent we can from this distance, your concern with that.
And the registries would probably like that, too, given their comment. They didn't like us of trying to compare the legacies with the new.
I mean, they might not like my rationale, but...
I know. All right, folks, we'll wrap it up. Barry, thanks a million, and thanks to everyone. We'll talk to you in a week.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.